Hark! It's an 87th Precinct podcast bonus episode. Paul here, just to do a very brief introduction for you to this episode. As we know, Evan Hunter, Sal Lombino, Ed McBain wrote under a variety of pseudonyms for doing different types of books and to increase his chances of selling different stories to different places. One of the things he did early on in his career was to write a few sci-fi or juvenile fiction stories, one of which was Danger, Dinosaurs. And that's what this episode is all about. You can find the book on Kindle. We talk all about that stuff in the episode. And I'm joined for this by my brother, Gary Abbott, who is a science fiction and speculative fiction writer himself, and he'll tell you all about that stuff in the episode. I've not done much editing on this, so it is full of ums and ahs and yeahs and sos, as there normally is in speech that you often don't hear because I cut a lot of them out. So I'll leave you with this then. Danger. Dinosaurs. So, Gary.
Hello.
We're sat here in a studio which was once your bedroom.
It was.
Your juvenile bedroom.
Mm-hmm.
Before you became a man.
Yeah.
And I was going to say fled the nest. Flew the nest, fled not the nest. Fled the nest.
Fled. Yeah, no, this is my old bedroom. And I seem to remember putting this desk up for Tony as well.
Yes, that's our stepdad. Mm-hmm. So, this is a room where, at one point, there would have been a small bookcase which would have contained some dinosaur books.
Yeah, we had a pretty dog-eared yellow dinosaur book, didn't we? Which
we had a copy of there was a National Geographic one, which was done like mock-ups of photographic things, like it was as if they'd gone back into the past.
Like a dinosaur spotter's guide, like the bird ones. No,
it was done as if someone had gone to the past, taken photos, nice photos.
Yeah.
That was the yellow one. And then we had two or three other dinosaur books that we'd inherited from cousins and things like that.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of
that. Books that somehow, for creatures that died out 100 million years ago, could go out of date still.
Yes, yeah, quite quickly. Yeah, I'd forgotten all about them. I remember the yellow one.
Anyway, regardless of that, hello.
Hello.
Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's not just nepotism that brings you on the podcast.
No.
It's partly the fact that I've convinced you to get into Ed McBain books.
Yeah.
But also because you've been writing yourself and you've published a few things.
Mm-hmm.
In the broad genre of the book that we're going to talk about today.
Very broadly, yeah. I've not done Time Slip / Dinosaurs, but it is sci-fi.
Is it, so what would you describe your output as? Now's your chance to sell
the
books.
Done a bit of time travel in one of my short stories. So I have dabbled with time travel. So the mechanics of it, I've understood a bit more. But I would say science fiction, speculative fiction. So more projecting to the future, kind of current day technologies. So whereas this has got. As soon as you put time travel into it, though, you're pretty solidly in science fiction. Because
yes,
you start to
always will be.
Ground yourselves into some of the rules that have kind of developed over the last century or so, I imagine. My books are a mixture of kind of... My short stories have a bit of time travel in them. I say no dinosaurs at this point. Some aliens, maybe.
So tell the nice ladies and gentlemen and people and everything what books you've published and where they can get them.
Okay, so my first book was called The Dimension Scales and Other Stories, which is a collection of short speculative fiction stories with a common, a unifying theme that links the stories together.
Mm-hmm.
And that is available through Amazon and other ebook retailers. But the best way to find any of these is to go on my website, which is www.garyabbott.co.uk.
We'll put
my
link up.
Blog, which is garyabbott.com, which will also have all my books advertised on it. My second book was called The Great Connection, which is a space opera, much more...
Hard sci-fi.
Yeah, a bit hard sci-fi. It's not full-on like Foundation series type.
No.
It's not epic in that sense. It was my first full-length one-story novel, 80,000 plus words, and that's about virtual reality kind of exploration of deep space in the future. And then my last book, just published, is called Transported, which is actually a comedy sci-fi, more in the vein of a Douglas Adams / Terry Pratchett style. genre kind of feel to it, which is about the teleportation technology and what could go wrong with the first use of it.
Yes.
So again, taking quite based on a lot of sci-fi rules, what we understand about teleportation, and then playing with what that would mean. Things like, you know, according to Star Trek, if you get teleported, you basically get destroyed and reconstructed at the other end. And if you were to add into that a layer of such thing as maybe a heaven or an afterlife, what would happen?
You'd get, yes, you've sort of explored the metaphysical implications of that in that book.
Which is a classic philosophical thought experiment about identity as well. So it's mixing them up, but it is using the rules of sci-fi, which I'm going to keep mentioning, the rules of sci-fi, because I think it'll become important later on.
Yes.
In this discussion, about Evan Hunter's little foray into sci-fi, which I'm guessing is one of his few.
Well, I'll tell you a little bit of background about this in a second, but your books are available basically through your website,
yeah.
And they're available as physical books and e-books.
Yes, you can get them as paperbacks, hardbacks, or what? No, not hardbacks.
No, they're paperbacks.
Paperbacks.
Soft cover.
Or e-books through Amazon, and the first one is on other platforms, the second two aren't. I think you can get them on Smashwords, the first two. But if you go looking for them, you will find them, and especially if you go to my website, because they are all over it. So please do.
Or just wander the streets of Stoke-on-Trent shouting Gary's name and he will reply.
Oh, yep.
And just before we get fully stuck into Ed McBain's or Evan Hunter's story or Richard Marston's story, then you. We should perhaps mention that you've now got into the 87th Precinct books.
Yes.
My badgering.
Yeah.
How are you finding it?
Yeah, I am. I'm really enjoying them. It's like you have spent several years kind of seeding the idea of these from kind of like, oh, there's these books I read and procedural, oh, that's nice. And then, oh, I'm doing a podcast about those books. And then obviously listening to the podcast and then buying me the books and then sitting me down and then making me read the books and putting matchsticks in my eyelids. I have really enjoyed them. It took me picking up the first one and reading it. And then it was like, well, these are great. I'll have to carry on now. And having the added bonus. Well, I started off by listening to your podcast without having read the books, which I enjoyed anyway, because I like hearing impassioned people talk about something. But after about six or seven, I think I thought, I'll read them and catch up. And now I'm at the point where I'm waiting for you to record the next ones. So, you know, I am pacing out my reading based on your podcast.
I think it's funny because growing up, I read a lot of books. You read a lot of books, watched a lot of telly, but I never thought of going and reading things like crime and mystery. That's perhaps because when you're younger, they don't do the categories in quite the same way they do as when you're older.
No. We didn't have any young crime stuff. We had some spy books.
Well, we had things like The Famous Five, which is sort of mystery.
Yeah, it's all
the same story every time.
Smugglers and caves, though, isn't it? It's all very coastal.
You're very cosy and coastal, and it happens every time they go on holiday.
Yeah.
But I suppose, probably thinking that, there's quite a lot of it. Mystery is the foundation for a lot of stories.
Yeah.
But then watching TV, we never used to watch crime stuff, except for the fact that we definitely watched Columbo.
We watched Columbo. I loved Columbo.
Yeah, I've always loved Columbo.
And I don't know if it was on at the same time every week, or it was just that it was on so often, you'd be like, oh, Columbo.
Yeah.
Put Columbo on. But I definitely watched a lot of Columbo.
In the 90s, certainly, when it was...
I have no idea if they were being shown in sequence or anything like that. I just remember watching a lot of Columbo. And that was about... That is my only founding in crime.
I never twigged on that as being police procedural, because it's not really police procedural, because he doesn't follow a procedure.
Yeah, unless your police procedure is having one bloke who does it.
To operate entirely outside of the structure of the police department. But it's police and crime story, and obviously there is a Columbo-McBain crossover as well.
Mm.
But years later, I really got stuck into Agatha Christie stuff, which is quite funny, because we were sat in the house opposite the filming location where they filmed one of the Agatha Christie Poirot stories for ITV in the early 90s.
Yeah.
We're literally, 400 metres from an Art Deco mansion?
Yeah, a very randomly kind of just preserved 1920s odd.
Well, it's not even preserved, it's just been constantly
lived
in.
Yeah, I mean, it's just in use. It's not like it's not some kind of location you can visit. It's not open to the public. It's just someone's house.
It's just someone's Art Deco mansion.
It's been a nursery for some years. It's been privately owned. It's kind of exchanged hands. It continues to exchange hands. But it's kind of set. We've never really seen it properly.
No, because it's set back lots of trees
behind a large hedgerow. But then one day we were walking the dog, and there was loads of old cars parked all up
and production vans production in the stuff, fields next to it.
And I remember when we actually finally watched the episode, it was hard because of the magic of TV to know which bits were and weren't the interiors from that place. And,
yeah,
and obviously the exteriors shots were all over the place.
I think it is actually, you know, I think it's series 2, episode 5, and I can't remember what story it is off the top of my head right away. Annoyingly, it seems to be one that's not repeated very often. But that happened opposite our house.
Yeah,
they shot night for day as well, I recall, because they had huge arc lamps going outside.
Yeah, okay. So they were lighting up the windows from so they could. It was LWT, wasn't it?
No, just ITV. Granada.
I remember seeing
London
signs
weekend television
hanging around.
Anyway, so there you go. Mm. That's the street we grew up on, it's a road, which goes houses, 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 farm, farm, Art Deco mansion,
nothing.
House, nothing.
Yeah.
Small stream.
And then,
so there you go. Background to our growing up there.
Yeah, so that's our crime background, isn't it? There isn't
our
one
crimey
really.
Background.
It's come later on, really.
I did start reading grown-up books. I'm doing that in air quotes, quite early on, because I whizzed through everything we had and a lot of stuff in the library. But that was tended to be things that Dad had lying around, which were sort of thrillers and stuff like that. Like Arthur Haley books, which I probably shouldn't have been reading at the age I was reading them, because they did contain quite a lot of, I believe the technical term is rumpy pumpy. Naughty bits.
Oh, were they hidden upstairs with the Ben Elton stand-up video?
Probably, yeah. And the Wicked Willy comic
pop-up book. I've read the Sherlock Holmes short stories. I think that's
That's what I moved on to when I made decisions.
That's my only real... I've read a bit...
Well, that's detective rather than crime, isn't it?
But definitely not procedural.
Anyway, this is definitely not police procedural that we're moving on to. The book we're looking at is Danger, Dinosaurs. That's Danger, colon, Dinosaurs.
The colon's very important.
Exclamation mark.
Yeah. Because you think of Danger what?
Yeah.
Dinosaurs.
I wonder if you could have had a range of stories. Like Danger, Loose Trains.
Well, yeah. Danger Aliens.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's a better one than Loose Train.
Loose Train, like Runaway Train.
Yeah, that's what I meant.
Runaway's more standard than Loose. Watch out, it's a Loose Train. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, Danger Dinosaurs. Great title. It tells you everything you need to know.
It does. It's a juvenile fiction book, as I believe how it was categorised originally, which tells you something you need to know about how people treat science fiction or treated science fiction. Is that it was generally, it wasn't, here's a science fiction book, which unless you were doing something like Foundation, it was caught, they were generally treated as juvenile fiction.
Yeah, it's a kind of adventure for boys type feel to it, doesn't it? But in
a little bit, yeah.
Yeah.
It's very much of its time and definitely of its style. It's written, and it's written by Richard Marston.
Right, I didn't know that. That's what
which is one of his pseudonyms that he used very early on.
Mm-hmm.
For a number of different types of books. It wasn't that he definitely used it as this is the juvenile fiction persona, because he did do other stuff published under that name. I think once he had a bank of pseudonyms, he scattered it across. And possibly in his mind, he had certain styles. I think with Ed McBain and Evan Hunter, he thought of those as two different styles of writing, which is why it's got a bit confused as things have been republished under either Ed McBain's name or Evan Hunter's name when they were once Richard Marston or Kurt Cannon or Ezra Hannon or all these different names he used. And it was published in 1953, so it's only about the fourth thing that he had fully published as a work.
Yeah. You can tell it is early in his career, in his development.
Yes, that's perhaps a better way of putting it. But it's now republished under Evan Hunter's name, I believe.
Well, yeah, I've just looked at the inset page and it does say published... Oh, well, where's it gone? It did say something about it being Evan Hunter as Richard Marston.
Yeah.
So it says, copyright 1953 by Evan Hunter as by Richard Marston.
As by.
Yeah, there's a few typos in this one.
There's quite a few typos, yeah. We should say that we've not read this in physical editions because they're very hard to come by and I think the reason for that is because they were cheap paperbacks at the time, perhaps even cheaper publications than the Permabook crime editions. So the few that have survived are in very bad nick and very hard to come by and therefore quite expensive. So we are reading this on Kindle, which you can get it through Kindle Unlimited or just buy it outright. Yeah, I had to read it on my phone, which is not a thrilling reading experience.
No.
But it's like it's been character scanned, isn't it? Because sometimes there's spelling mistakes where like M's turn up instead of like an IN or UN or whatever.
I do very, very hastily transcribed by someone. Yeah. Very hastily.
But if I just go over the sort of start of Evan Hunter's career, the first couple of juvenile fiction books he put out were Find the Feathered Serpent, which was 1952, which he put out under his own name. I think it's his first registered publication. He did one called Rocket to Luna in 1953 as Richard Marsden.
Okay.
Then Danger Dinosaurs comes along. Yeah. There's a couple of early crime stories in there as well. This is published just before he publishes The Blackboard Jungle, which is a hugely important book in his career and also culturally, coming along in 1954 as it does and tying into the start of rock and roll and the sort of the media scares that all surrounded that. And it was one of the flagship pieces that people were hanging on about kids behaving badly in schools.
About gangs and things, is it?
Gangs within schools or sort of the way, and tying it into rock and roll music when the film came out.
Mm.
And obviously this is a very big and important book early in Evan Hunter's career, set him up for life, really, in terms of establishing him as a writer. In a way that Danger Dinosaurs, I don't think was ever going to do.
Did it not?
No, funnily enough.
You may be the first people who've read this since 1954. I don't know.
Yeah.
You have to start somewhere though, don't you? And also, when you find your stride and you find your voice, I think things can click into place. So presumably, this feels almost written to brief to me. He was writing for children and needed to impart some information about dinosaurs. So maybe it's pretty hard to find your voice if you're going to be a gritty, culturally rooted crime writer when you're writing about time travelling and dinosaurs. Maybe it's just he was never going to be comfortable in his voice in this. You know.
I think he was just trying lots of things. And also part of the reason for having the pseudonyms was partly to give a bit of delineation between what he wrote, but mainly because it meant he could sell more stories to the same magazines.
Yeah.
Because they wouldn't it's Evan Hunter again. Or Evan Hunter again. I've got one from Richard Marston, one from Ed McBain, one from Kurt Cannon, one, you know, stuff like that. So he was being canny.
Yeah.
Because he was also at some points working for the publishers that he was sending these stories to. But he was learning to write quite early on, and a lot of these things are hang-ups of that development. Stuff that you would have done in nowadays in creative writing courses and things like that, perhaps, as part of your development.
Well, this reminds me, I did a book before doing my, because I did creative writing at Open University, but prior to that I wrote a novella, and the mistakes I was making in that without formal training or a lot of experience behind me seem reminiscent of some of them in this, like, you know, little slipping of perspective here and there, of who's been written for and where, what viewpoint from. But still, an accomplished bit of writing. You can tell the seeds of what is to come from here. So it is really worth, I think, exploring as a fan.
Yeah, definitely. There's a couple of little bits of information. Not much I can find out about this. It's not like he was asked about this over the years. So there's not acres of research and interview materials.
Yeah.
But we can tell from the book that it was dedicated to Shirley, his mother-in-law.
Yeah.
So that was of his first wife. And there's a thanks in there to Dr. Frederick P. Young, who is a geologist.
Mm-hmm.
And I did a little bit of research, and I could have actually found out quite a lot about him, because being an academic, they are generally very well mapped, and their work and research is published, even if it was from earlier in the last century. So Frederick P. Young was a geologist. He was born in 1904, died in 2003, so he lived a good long life.
Very, very good long life.
And the important thing is that he joined the geology faculty at Hunter College in New York in the 1930s, which is where, and he stayed there for a long time, and that was where Evan Hunter, or Sal Lombino, went after the war. He came back and went to college there, And Hunter is thought to be one of the places where he took inspiration for his name.
Which
from.
He denies.
He denies but that. But
it sounds like it.
Well, he went to Evander High School and Hunter College. Yeah. It's.
I think even if he doesn't realise he took it from there, he probably did.
At least I suspect he was
subconsciously.
He was. He's been playing games with people, but. But the point is, he went there. So presumably, after he came out of the Navy, he went and did his degree there in English and psychology, and. He would have thought, well, if I need to go and get some facts checked, which we know he did. So that's an important, interesting thing. At the start of this book, he says, I went and checked this with a geologist who studies the Jurassic period. And he said, A-OK, Sal or Evan. And
which is it does lend the book, I think, a bit of an authority because he obviously has... some of the names down. We have the names. Some of the dinosaurs.
Some of the Latin names.
Yeah, and he, you know, he's learned a bit of the flora and fauna of the time, so that he can pepper it with.
Well,
facts.
One of my favourite thing is he. Sometimes Evan Hunter has a thing that he seizes on in books, and it might be one term or one word even that he uses over and over again. It's almost like he's learnt it new, and he likes to use it. And in this one, it's the word is cycad.
Cycad. That, I was going to say, how are you going to say it? Is it cycad? Yeah.
Well, it's C-Y-C-A-D. Yes.
I use the one good thing about using a Kindle is being able to click on the word and say, give me a definition.
Oh,
and I was
thinking,
looking at thinking, I think that's a plant.
Yeah.
And it is. It's a Jurassic plant that is.
So they still exist today. They're basically the types of seed-bearing palms and things like that. Mm. But it's basically all the plants that if someone says to you, we need to film a Jurassic scene. Yeah. You go out and fill it up with these types of plants.
Yeah.
So rather than him talk about specific things, he just used the word cycad over and over and over again.
There's a lot of cycads in this.
So there. Yeah. You probably could do a count on how many. I don't know. You searched. But we won't do that now.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's one of the ones he's really clearly learned it and thought, this is a handy term, so I don't have to describe too much. If I just say this is in there.
I mean, in pre-Wikipedia days, having a geologist... at your kind of and a Jurassic expert at your beck and call to help you with research must have been very valuable.
Yeah, definitely. So let's get into this book. Let's, as always, what I like to do when we start is just, what are your general impressions, Gary? I think some of it's come across already.
Yeah, so like I said, I think it's got that kind of adventure for boys and, you know, in that sense that you used to get those big collections of kind of
I used to like them. Yeah. They were all sort of war era, sort of derring do and adventure.
In many ways, it's very linear. It's a journey story. It's an adventure story. It's got dinosaurs and running around, and it's got, you know, it's all the kind of stuff that would make for good
dinosaurs and running around are the main thing that children like.
Yeah, and that's it. And actually, there's not a huge lot of difference between this and, you know, your Michael, I want to say Crichton, but some people say Crichton or Crichton.
Crichton.
Michael Crichton type of, it's got the same core element, which is dinosaurs and running around. It gets there differently. And that's fine. It's got a bit of intrigue and subplot going on there as well, you know. And it's got this kind of sci-fi device, which offers another dimension to it in the centre of it, which I'm sure we'll get onto. And it was an enjoyable read. It's not very long. So
it's not very long at all.
It's a short kind of read. It's, but it does feel like a young writer's kind of, or someone maybe downplaying their ability because of the genre.
Yeah, thinking,
I don't need to do too much because of this, but actually could have got away with more. But he seems to also develop as it goes through. About halfway through, he starts offering kind of italicised, in this edition anyway, kind of introductions to the scenes, which kind of like, you know, almost like directorial kind of vignettes of what's happening, which sound like the beginnings of chapters in the 87th Precinct.
A little series. Bit, I suppose. And also, what starts to creep in this is there's a bit of social commentary as well.
Yeah, yes, definitely.
Quite heavy-handed, I'd say, but often in the 87th Precinct, it's quite heavy-handed as well. So social commentary about people's station and behaviour towards each other, and people's behaviour towards people who are different to them, and things like that. And then there's a very much... It's a bit like this sounds like some stupid thing to say, but it's a bit like a Shakespeare problem play. This children's book by Evan Hunter,
yeah.
In that it gets to the end and it's like, I've just got to wrap this up now. So oh, yeah. Shakespeare would always go, right, you marry him,
yeah.
They go off there, this happens Deus to this person, this baddie does this. This is sort of what happens in the last chapter of this book. In fact, in the last section of the last chapter of this book.
Yeah. It does it by a means, though, that has been introduced. I mean, I think we're going to have to deal with this means, although I guess you want to kind of set the scene for the
book.
Well,
I'll set the scene. The nature of the book is we meet Chuck Spencer, mm-hmm. the brother of the guide, Owen Spencer, who is hired to take people on time slips.
Yes.
Time slips being a technological method whereby they can go back in time to, in this case, the Jurassic period, mm-hmm. and safely, mm-hmm. in theory, observe the flora and fauna of that period. And the implication is that this is something that, well, actually, I say that now and I've started to doubt myself straight away, but the implication sort of is that it's something that rich people do, like going on safari.
Yeah, it's
except that he does say that there's a thing called, and this is a brilliant device, I love this, tempomaniacs.
Yeah.
People are addicted to time slips and go on them even when they shouldn't be.
How did they do that?
Yeah.
Because actually it's
supposed to be regulated by the government, isn't it?
So unless the technology has become, it's regulated, however, it doesn't stop people.
When they get there, being
it
weird.
Does have a, that does
our voices good. Keep breaking. It's like being in your bedroom from when we were kids.
we're time slipping back to being 13.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're right. That does offer a nice little kind of glimpse of a wider world. The tempomaniacs who want to escape like time hermits. They want to go back to times before there's any. So whereas everyone on this tour, this very expensive tour they've paid for with guides, are meant to be contained within a force field when they arrive, where they will camp. They're kind of in a force field bubble, aren't they? Where they spend a week. Where nothing can kind of get in or out, but they can hang around the perimeter with binoculars and cameras and hunt via the media of photography.
Yeah, the only thing you'll be shooting are cameras,
exactly.
Taking pictures. But as I say, Chuck Spencer's the our main character, and he's along for the ride because he's there with his brother. And the party of five that have paid for this under. The main guy who's paid for this is a guy called Dirk Masterson.
Dirk Masterson.
Who I've written down his role in the book is simply baddie.
He is baddie, yes.
And he's there with his obsequious little assistant, Brock Gardell.
He is baddie number two.
He is baddie.
Yeah. He is snivelling baddie.
Yeah.
Rather than main baddie. He's like his little sidekick baddie.
He's the one that you actually want to have offed before you want the main baddie off because he's so annoying. And then the rest of the party is Masterson's niece, Denise.
Denise.
I'm going to just forget that out.
I didn't realise that.
I have no doubt that Evan Hunter would have gone, what can I call the niece?
Denise. I've only saying it out loud.
Yeah.
I've thought that, yeah. Yeah, Denise.
I think that probably works even in a New York accent.
Denise. That wasn't a New York accent.
No, that wasn't.
No.
But also Pete, his cook.
Yeah.
And who just is weird. And Arthur, who is a sort of...
He's a hired hand,
a dog's body, in fact. He is essentially a slave.
Yes.
He's used as such to explore issues of...
Of race, because he's black as well, isn't he? So they very much use his status.
It's interesting because the main black character in the 87th Precinct is called Arthur Brown.
Yeah.
And the black character in this book is called Arthur. It's a bit like...
Maybe,
I don't know. Was it a huge, important name for African Americans at the time? I don't know.
Or maybe when he was thinking about his characters for the 87th, he thought he just already had it in his head, having already concocted a character.
And later on, we come across a couple of displaced scientists who... Yeah. Despite being doctors and specialists in geology and paleontology, can't stand in the right place to get back from the time slip and they're trapped there for 6 months.
It's unclear how that time slip... Yeah, I suppose because they purposefully were meant to leave their force field and go looking for...
Oh, yes, they were sponsored to go and...
They're searching for a uranium deposit.
Is that the big revelation you were going on about when you were talking to me the other day?
No.
All right, okay, we'll come to that.
No, my big revelation is... I we will get to, and I'm gonna presume that we're not going to find too much spoilers in this.
I
can do it.
Do you know what?
Spoilers.
I think we can pretty much not worry about it for this.
But the uranium thing, no, but that's why they're there, isn't it? But we don't know that till later on. But that in itself isn't that important when we first meet them. It's just that that's why they're there.
Yeah.
They were sent to find. It's kind of like, then that idea is quite interesting as well, mining the past to feed the future.
Literally mining the
past. Yeah. However, it's that he does say something about what they're mining is in order to kickstart a self-perpetuating uranium kind of refinery.
Yeah.
So that he almost...
Well, early 50s, nuclear things are very much in the public consciousness, not least because of the end of the Second World War and what happened in Japan. And then obviously the start of people trying to rebuild industries, try to rebuild the world and get won over on each other by having the more powerful systems, be it for energy or warfare. So it's not surprising that that crops up in the middle of a science fiction book from the period. But basically, Chuck and Owen are taking these guys back in time.
Yeah.
And they're doing it via a time slip mechanism.
Time slip. Yeah, the time slip, yeah.
So what about the mechanism? Let's have some of this sci-fi stuff.
I mean, that seems pretty standard to me.
Oh yeah.
Time slip.
You sound like a mechanic.
He does kind of give you a bit of a description of it. He says, it's literally the beginning of the book. Let us imagine an intricate combination of tubes and coils and relays and knobs and dials and knife switches.
I don't know what a knife switch is. No. I think that must just be like a throw switch.
Yeah. Let us suppose that the mind of man has so combined these unrelated pieces of machinery as to allow them to alter the steady progress of time, and let us call its combination a time slip. And then it goes on to say how it can take you back wherever you want, and you could go back to the Egyptians, or you could go back to the Crusades, or why not the Jurassic period, which is indeed what they do.
And why not?
Yeah. That's very topical.
Oh, yes, it is.
Seeing as the film has just been cancelled.
That's entirely irrelevant to our listeners.
Yeah. And then they don't really say much more about it. All my mental image of it, I read the first few chapters a little while back, so it's a bit fuzzy compared to the rest of it, which I read very recently. My mental image of it is a kind of a big energy force field that you stand in the middle of a kind of a patch of land, which presumably maps to the patch of land that you're going to arrive in. So you stay stationary in space, but you move in time.
Yeah.
So time moves around you kind of as you stand there, and you appear where you were standing, but in a previous time, which geologically would probably cause problems.
Yeah, no, it just suddenly occurred to me that the
you'd
idea
probably
of
be in a mountain or
Pangaea and the movement of land masses and stuff like that.
Yeah, but that doesn't really matter. And that you stay in this bubble until such a time as that time slip, like a week later, like you said, is recalled, and it will.
So there's no activation method to get back from when you're
When then there's
you're
no
there yourself.
On the other side.
It needs to be someone in the future or the now.
The technology is in the present for the characters. To the technology of the to activate and recall it. There is no, they don't have any. It's like a chute, I guess, that you get shot down a pipe, which lands you somewhere, and you can get sucked up that pipe. But wherever you land, you don't have any way of switching it on or off.
So, you need someone to lower a ladder.
That to me fits some nice rules. It's a portal type thing, you know.
Well, he describes it as being like an LP, like a record, doesn't he? And how the grooves don't disappear just because you've reached the edge of the record. They're still there. So what the time slip does is literally slips you back across all those grooves.
Yes, it does. I remember that now, yeah.
Which feels like one of those sort of ideas that makes almost sense, but at the same time makes absolutely no sense.
Which would be fine if the record was kind of warped upon itself.
Yeah.
Rather than a flat disc.
Yeah, it's an interesting theory, but
that you lift up and like time is like a groove in a I'd forgotten about that.
It's just basically saying the past continues to exist even though you've reached this point. So if we could just pick up you, the needle on the record player, and move you back into one of those other grooves,
into a time stream.
Yeah,
which again, as I'll get to with my big problem slash kind of revelation with this causality, which he goes on to explore.
Yeah, so if something changes in the past,
there would be
a knock-on effect.
There are rules and regulations about
classic time travel.
It's the butterfly effect.
Yeah.
As we all know how that works.
someone stands on a butterfly in the past and the modern day is full of loose trains.
Yeah, that's it. So we will, I guess the record, the groove on the record kind of gives you, is in line with that kind of concept.
But as we've talked about here, the technology is, when they get back, there's a safe force field that starts just surrounding them.
Yeah.
Then expands out to something like a mile or something like that.
It gives them a...
And so it's perfectly safe. Nothing could go wrong.
No.
Unless you've invited a rich idiot who really wants to shoot dinosaurs with real guns and that.
Yeah, and has brought a lot of real guns along with him and no one has...
So they've brought... Not only the seven of them have gone anyway.
Yeah.
They've also brought a jeep.
Yeah.
And a truck.
A jeep and a truck, yeah.
And the truck somehow is full of guns, despite the fact that they're not allowed to take guns to the
guns
past. And... So they haven't inspected it.
Yeah, guns and explosives.
Yeah. Mm. Although there's a sequence in that where it goes, oh, there's TNT in here, when they're having to unload this truck at some point. And then it's never mentioned again.
No, but you know why that is, don't you?
Well, yeah. But it's...
So yeah,
their checks and balances aren't.
Really. They haven't really nailed it, have they? They're very, you know, especially as the main guy, does it? Owen is very like, come on, you can't mess with things. We've got to be careful. But he wasn't really that careful in going out there in the first place with this fellow and his entourage and his small armoury.
So Dirk Masterson, immediately his first act is to get in the jeep and drive it full pelt at a force field.
Yeah.
And which, of course, causes the force field to short out, not damaging the jeep at this point, I know.
No.
But meaning that there's no protection between them and the dangers of the Jurassic period.
No.
Which is mainly huge plant-eating dinosaurs.
Yeah.
And the threat, the constant threat of Allosaurus.
Yeah, that's the main beastie in this one, isn't it?
It is. And I am glad that he's steered away from doing...
Tyrannosaurus
Rex and getting all the time periods mixed up and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, isn't Tyrannosaurus not Jurassic?
No, it's later. Yeah. But Allosaurus is smaller and more deadly.
Yeah.
And I think it's a better fit for this as a sort of threat of, like, if we come across one of these, that's it.
And also, was the Tyrannosaurus... I'd have to research it, but was the Tyrannosaurus as big a dinosaur celebrity as it is nowadays following Jurassic Park and things like that? What was it at the time? Would you have known?
I seem to recall it was always the big one, because when we were growing up, all the dinosaurs... We weren't growing up in the 50s, no, but we were reading dinosaur books from the 70s and 80s. And
it was always present, wasn't it? Yeah. I don't know if it was discovered, though. I don't know if its fossil record kind of could have popped up since... Maybe it was already...
Oh, yeah, of course it was.
Yeah.
Because he mentions Tyrannosaurus.
Oh, does he?
Yeah. Right. He just says, that comes later.
Right.
He knows what he's talking about. They didn't discover Tyrannosaurus Rex in 1955.
Oh, I didn't know.
And him go, oh, shucks, just missed.
Yeah, okay.
So it's a limited range of dinosaurs in this, but that makes sense because it feels a bit more grounded.
Four, isn't there? There's Stegosaurus.
Stegosaurus, Diplodocus.
Yes, and also...
The other one, Brontosaurus.
Brontosaurus. There's
the Allosaurus,
and there's the swimmy ones.
The Ichthyosaur,
And the Pterosaur.
And the Pterosaur, and then there's a couple of mentions of Archaeopteryx. Darn Archaeopteryx.
That's it. Yeah. That is it. I mean, we don't see that one, but that's enough, really. That's enough dinosaurs, and there's more than one of them.
Yeah,
there's more. Herds.
There's a couple of stampedes.
Yeah, it would put me in mind of things like King Kong, you know.
Kong, Skull Island.
Yeah, not the one before, the Peter Jackson one, especially where they have like stampeding dinosaurs.
Oh, yeah.
And it would have made, if it was, you know, if it was ever picked up as the script for a film, it would make quite an exciting film, were it not for the massive fundamental time problem in the middle of it.
Yes. But you're all right, when you read this, if you actually thought of this in terms of the script of something like Jurassic Park...
Yeah.
This is not so far.
It's not. You've got...
I mean, it's badly drawn characters, particularly. Yeah. Or very simple characters, let's say. It's characters that kids can get a handle on very easily.
Yeah.
But actually, for a lot of sci-fi TV, a lot of sci-fi film, time travel stuff, this is well in that ballpark.
It hits the beats for something, for a good sci-fi almost switch your brain off, but with a little bit more to it, just enough to kind of keep maybe cross your audience a bit between kids and older folk. Like, it has your Mad Hunter, basically. It has your...
Your big game hunter.
Your big game hunter who wants to get a prize, or does he? But, you know, that's the conceit that starts the whole chain of events. That he's a... Your Jurassic Park, your second Jurassic Park, your Lost World guy played by
you can click your fingers at me, I can't remember.
Oh, you know the British actor, Pete.
Pete? Oh, yes, he's dead now.
Pete
Postlethwaite.
Postlethwaite.
Yes.
He could be Masterson. Masterson. He could be Masterson.
Although I'd love to hear sort of Pete Postlethwaite doing, "I am Pete Postlethwaite and I'm playing Dirk Masterson."
Yeah. Because he also has not a slimy assistant, but he has like an assistant. But those archetypes are good. They're good for this kind of a story, aren't they?
They are. It's flimsy structurally, but yeah, you could easily turn this into a script of an episode of TV or it could even turn it into an episode of Doctor Who, for goodness sake.
Yeah.
And it would be all right.
I think you could get a film out of it. I mean, they shoot some Stegosaurus and have to escape from a stampede of Stegosaurus. And although I found out something from this, which is that is the genus, isn't it?
Oh, we're all terribly naive on our dinosaur.
Yeah, the Stegosaur is a type of dinosaur of which there are several. Any one which is armor-plated kind of Jurassic. And they do the same with the Brontosaurus as well, don't they?
Yeah.
That would be a bit repetitive. Now it's the Brontosaurus stampede.
I think that's just him sort of going, here's some different dinosaurs, here's some land dinosaurs that look like this, here's some swamp-dwelling dinosaurs that look like this.
And this is...
Shall we deal with the fact that when he meets the Brontosauruses and it all goes wrong, because... Masterson can't stop himself shooting at these things, causing a stampede.
Yeah.
They can't quite get away. Owen Spencer, the guide, saves Masterson.
Saves Masterson.
At the expense of his own life.
Yeah.
He gets properly flattened
by a stampeding
Brontosaurus. And suddenly, Chuck Spencer is without his brother. He's just seen him die.
He goes to bury him.
And is this the point at where you're...
This is where it all, to me, unfolds. Like, a badly folded thing. Because...
Okay. Like shit origami.
Yeah, basically. Unfortunately, so what he seems to have done here... And I found this really, really fascinating.
Go on.
Not just as a sci-fi writer, but as anyone who's ever watched any sci-fi. It might be something to do with the canon of sci-fi that's happened since this, which makes this so solidified.
Makes us used to a certain way of it, definitely.
He even talks about it. So he does talk about the fact that you've got to be careful in the past, like we said, with the butterfly effect. Because if you squish something in the past, if enough things in the past, or you cause enough of a disruption to the past, you are going to affect the present. As we all know, you go back in time, you shoot your grandparent, you're never born.
The grandfather
you've got paradox and things like
paradox,
that.
That's the word I'm
you could stop yourself
complex.
Ever having existed, etc. Right? So he talks about that to prime you, because this is for kids. He gives them that idea that we
which is already really difficult once you start thinking about it in any.
It is, because
it drives you mad, because if you can't do the thing that you've caused to happen because
and that's one of the reasons that scientists rather than science fiction have come up with as being one of the reasons that. That time travel can't, it's almost a feedback loop. You know, Stephen Hawking says it would kind of cancel itself out, or it would just cause some mad explosion because of. Anyway, that's not the main thing he's trying to get across here is you've got to be careful in the past because you can bugger up the future.
Yes. Yeah.
So Owen dies, and you think, oh well, that's just part of the plot, you know. And now Chuck is kind of like he's becoming the leader of the group because he just happens to be the brother of the guide. So he's in some ways
to assume the mantle.
Yeah, and also he's chastised Masterson for what happened. So he's kind of, because he's angry about what's happened to his brother, he's kind of captured almost Masterson and guard down and kept them, said, like, you've got to stay in line now. You're causing all this chaos. We just need to get back to the rendezvous site. But then he starts thinking, because my brother, why am I? Am I the guide? And then he starts getting confused about because, and then he realises that the reason. He's having trouble remembering Owen, his brother, and his role in the whole affair is starting to shift. So he's becoming the guide.
Yeah.
And no one else remembers him going off to bury his brother. Very quickly, everyone else forgets
Owen ever existed.
And he thinks to himself, oh, of course, he's died millions of years before he was ever born. He never existed. And now time needs to adjust. I was like, no, it doesn't.
It doesn't at all.
No, because he hasn't been born yet.
Yeah.
We're used to this.
His death in the past has no implication on his birth in the future.
It's really interesting because it subverts the rules, but not in a good way. It subverts them in a logical way, that even though none of this is real anyway, you have to start questioning. You know, you start getting a bit... I was thinking, this is against the rules of time travel, which don't exist because there is no such thing. But we know that if you go back in the past and die, you're just dead. You weren't never born.
Yeah.
Because you're still going to get born.
Because your presence in the past doesn't affect the events that lead ultimately to your birth.
And the only thing I can possibly reconcile this with, and he kind of mentions it-ish, but I don't think it's him, what he thinks. I think he's just got the concept wrong. Is that there is some kind of self-writing mechanism to the universe, some extraordinary element to the universe beyond just kind of the logistics of a linear timeline, which just doesn't allow the same person to exist out of order.
Yeah.
If he's existed at some point and then dies, that's it. Like that iteration of the person is the only one that can have been. I think he's just made a mistake with it. I think he loves the idea, or he likes, I say loves, probably a strong word. He's really intrigued by the idea and has thought this will make an interesting plot device. And it does, because then all the roles change and all the statuses change, because the brother becomes the guide. Everyone else treats him as the guide. He still can kind of remember his brother because he had more to do with him, but it's slipping away from him.
That's quite sad as well, that bit.
It is sad,
because he's desperately trying to cling to this memory.
Yeah.
And it's a bit like Back to the Future as you see the photo fade.
Well, exactly. Yeah, that's the thing that makes it more infuriating, is that would be fine if for some reason they'd caused his brother never to have been born.
Yeah.
Which is...
But we hadn't affected his birth.
No, we had nothing to do with it. We had nothing to do with it.
Unless they affected everyone.
In which case, they'd all be.
Yeah, yeah. They'd all
be. And then he also does this kind of time-snapping back type of thing, which is... That's something that Doctor Who explores, that time will kind of find almost like Final Destination films as well. But there'll be some extra force, some supernatural force, will make time snap back into place. So just because his brother's dead doesn't mean that expedition never happened.
No.
What happened was that Chuck's entire life starts to be repositioned by some benevolent kind of puppet master, so that his life, he ended up being a guide for time tours, even though he starts to remember a new timeline for himself, which enables that set of circumstances to still happen with the people who are left.
Yeah, that's quite interesting.
What would probably have happened is that if his brother had never existed, it doesn't mean that he would have had anything to do with that. He might not have. And even if he had, why would that set of people still have come together? It would have been too chaotic a change to the timeline for it to have resulted in that.
Yeah.
So, which again, Back to the Future is guilty of as well, because just because he was never born doesn't mean there'd still be a family photo, but without him in it, they're all in the same place with their arms around each other. He's just not there.
Yeah.
It's still, it would probably have caused too much disruption for that photo to have ever taken place. But as he just gets it so wrong. I had to read it two or three times. Like, no. No, that's not how it works. And it's really weird because it's just not how it works. I don't think anyone now would accept that's how it works, would they?
I think, even an inexperienced reader of sci-fi or an editor or someone would pick up on that and go, are you sure
about this?
Because he uses it again, because at some point we finally get Brock Gardell gets killed.
Yes, he does.
Thankfully.
Mm-hmm.
And so he goes out of it and then that changes everything again.
Yes, and then he...
And that obviously changes relationships between people.
Mm-hmm.
And generally what happens to the people who remain, though, it benefits them. Their status generally is improved within the world by virtue of these other people not being in it.
Yeah.
Just a quick word about Pete the Cook.
Pete the Cook, the singing cook.
Why is he in it?
I'm not sure. He doesn't really do just to feed everybody, I think.
Well, I'm quite glad that he didn't bring the character Denise, the niece, along and say, well, you're the cook.
No, and that's she's not good. Although she needs to be rescued a lot, she's more neutral than anything. She's not a screamer. No. She's unfortunate in that she has to be...
There's a seeds of a love story there, but it doesn't quite play out.
Yeah.
Between her and Chuck. She has a nasty experience with an ichthyosaur. Arthur has much more to do because he is paid by Masterson, but clearly believes in doing things right and has had enough as well.
Yeah.
And eventually they come across these two displaced scientists who forgot what they were supposed to be doing and where they were. Well, they knew what they were doing, but they forgot about where to get back and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So they're essentially... They think they're tempo maniacs, but they're actually
geologists. Jolly misunderstanding, isn't there, where they all think each other are tempo maniacs. They think that they're tempo maniacs, and they think that they're tempo maniacs.
But it turns out that they've been sent back to find uranium, which does exist in ore form, uraniumite or something, and has done forever, but there's very little of it to be found on Earth now.
Right.
So the theory being that perhaps in the past there was bigger deposits of it.
Okay.
And that's what they're hunting for, which is a good evil government sort of twisty plot, isn't it?
Yeah.
Really? Of like let's mine the past.
Although I do think that they say that it's to kind of kickstart almost a self-perpetuating energy source.
Nah.
Because they don't want them to be the baddies. He doesn't want them to be baddies for mining the past, because as we find out, because there is a twist, there's more of a twist to this, isn't there? From Masterson isn't just a bullish hunter who has decided to, what's the word?
Shoot everything
and sabotage the expedition on purpose, which is always left a bit in doubt whether it wasn't. He kind of says, oh, well, look, the force field's gone and I've brought a load of guns, so may as well shoot stuff from here. Why not?
Yeah.
We've got a week. Let's shoot everything. Yeah. And that you think that's the extent of the problem, but we mentioned the dynamite before.
Yeah,
and actually, what we think he might be there to do when we meet the scientist is maybe he wasn't there just to.
I read it very quickly, I must say. I got the impression that he was more of an opportunist. He's the sort of man who would take dynamite along with him to the bathroom in case.
I think he was explicitly there to find the scientist.
All right, you think so?
I think what they realised, he's playing a kind of a double game. He wants them to think he's just this spoiled rich man who wants to hunt things, which he is as well.
Mm-hmm.
But he's there because it was public knowledge that these scientists went missing searching for uranium.
Oh, yes, of course.
So he wants to actually, because he keeps on asking them to double back to where they found the scientists. So they find the scientists and they all team up and they all want to get back to the rendezvous site together because they're all lost. And Chuck has got a general idea of where they're heading. But Masterson, who's kind of fallen into line since the death of Owen, wants them to go back to the cave.
Yeah,
because he thinks that where they were there because that's near the, and he literally wants to mine uranium and physically take it back with him. He doesn't want to establish a mining site that he can return to. He just wants to
fill a truck with uranium,
like you do. I mean, I'm guessing it's dangerous. Well, you'd need specialist equipment.
It needs to be enriched, you see, before it becomes too dangerous. But although I don't think you'd want to be handling too much of it.
No.
I shouldn't imagine.
And they didn't bring a whole mining operation with them. They brought some dynamite.
Yeah, and so if someone sort of went, right, we need to load the truck and get back now, you'd be thinking, oh, this truck's a bit heavier than when we arrived. Oh, it's full of rocks.
Yeah. But then they never check them on the way out, so I'm sure they don't check them on the way in.
But of course, Allosaurus makes an appearance.
Yes.
The fabled Allosaurus.
Yeah.
And it does exactly what you want it to do. Which is it bites Masterson's head off.
Yeah.
Or snaps him in half.
Kind of. I imagined it as a kind of midriff.
All right, yeah.
Snapping.
That would look good on screen.
Mm.
Very Jurassic Park.
Yeah.
Or Jurassic World, whatever. Because the party's been split by this point and there's all sorts of hostage exchanges going on.
Yeah.
And in the middle of it, Allosaurus.
Allosaurus. Just like Jurassic Park, where the Tyrannosaurus Rex is always kind of the broker of a scene, that he comes in and sorts out whatever's happening. If there's some tense, it might be between humans and velociraptors or humans and humans, but what tends to happen, especially in the last couple of films, is Tyrannosaurus Rex comes in And because he goes, yeah, but I'm massive. So so you blah, and then that's the end of it. And he does that, you know, he does that much like you'd expect in a tense finale of a film.
Yeah. Right, we need to get towards wrapping this up. So mm-hmm. basically, who's died? Brock's died. Dirk's died. Owen's died. Does Pete die?
No.
Okay. And they finally get back to the rendezvous just in time to be zipped back to the future. And or bounced back to the future across the platter of time.
So, yeah, so Dirk's dead. That's the important thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Dirk's dead. So the baddie's dead.
And when we get back, time has done all its corrections.
As it wouldn't, yeah.
Yeah, exactly as it wouldn't. And Chuck has assumed he just is a...
Oh, yeah.
A time slip guide now.
Yeah, he's forgotten all about his brother.
Denise is not just some girl who's come along for the ride. She's the forefront of a new set of female time slip guides, because ladies can do it as well.
They thought they might like the female touch.
Yeah.
They said.
It's a little bit condescending.
There's a little bit of that, yeah. It's kind of like, they thought, oh, they can do it, and it might be nice for some of the guests to have a female host. But she is on her, because you have to do like, it's like flying hours, isn't it? You have to do like 10 tours before you get your full license and things. And she's a trainee, because she's Denise of nothing now, because her uncle has disappeared from time.
And Arthur, his very put upon, more or less slave, the slave of Masterson, the decision he didn't make in the earlier part of his life, which is referred to in the book, has come true, and he turns out that he's the multimillionaire who's funded this trip.
Yeah.
And it was just
an accident.
Yeah.
Presumably, because what we end up with is the end of a book we haven't read.
I suppose in a way that's quite clever.
It is kind of clever, but it does mean that you don't... I mean, you've seen a route through it, I guess. You have seen the end of a book, but you don't... None of that... According to their time, none of that happened, so... Like you say, presumably someone did accidentally drive a truck against a force field.
Yeah.
They did, but no one died. So they didn't have any of the encounters when anybody died, because they didn't lose anybody.
Yeah.
If in a nice way, his way of rendering time kind of gets rid of death. Because no one dies, because every time someone dies, they never existed. So everyone who comes back from the past is always... No one's ever died.
Yeah, but all their stations have been improved, I think. I can't remember what happens with Pete.
Yeah, it's good for the people who left.
Yeah, they're sort of doing all right.
Well, Arthur's completely gone up in the world. He's become this...
But that's part of his social commentary. This is a McBain Hunter social commentary bit about if you remove the obstacles to people's progression, happiness, opportunity, then people will get better.
Yeah.
And... One of the big ways that plays out, especially in America, especially in the 1950s, is between the relationship between African Americans and white people, or any of the various races that sort of come together in places like New York and things like that, which is what he explores in the 87th Precinct.
Yeah.
And here it's played out with Arthur being... But the only thing is, it's, you know, he just describes Arthur all the way through as being, he was a brown man.
Yeah.
His big brown hands. Everything. It's like, well, all right, we've established this.
Yeah.
We don't need a reminder every time. His brown legs.
Yeah. he leaves you in no doubt.
That he is brown.
That he's a brown, yeah.
He's a brown man. But anyway, he turns out he's a multimillionaire now.
Yeah, he just, you know, Evan Hunter obviously has no... He's no qualms about it. He elevates him to being this millionaire kind of guy at the end. But as I say, it must be funny, because at the other end, they must be sending off 20 people on expeditions and 2 people coming back and go, another successful trip.
Yeah.
Everyone's come, you know, because they have, no one dies. It just doesn't
work. No one died.
But along the journey is a fun one.
Yeah.
And that concept only comes in halfway through. And it does have interesting... It is interesting to subvert the rules sometimes and say, well, okay, we're used to this, let's see what... And it does lead to nice consequences for the life.
Nice consequences.
For those who survive.
So we need to sum up, Gary, and what we need to do is, I've brought the portable version of Kenneth with me.
Okay.
To calculate the score. But of course, because we're doing a new thing outside of the 87th Precinct, we need to decide what unit of measurement we're going to use. So what's appropriate to this?
I would say something to do with dinosaurs.
Probably.
Yeah. Or time slips. I don't know if you can do...
You can't count.
Time slips out of time slips.
I would say perhaps... The obvious one would be dinosaur scales or feathers.
Right.
This is a pre-feathered dinosaur.
Well, he talked about the birds.
Well, the Archaeopteryx, we knew that.
Yeah, right? He doesn't go full on that all dinosaurs evolved into birds. He just talks about a certain branch of dinosaurs evolving into birds, yeah. Doesn't he? I think dinosaur scales...
Let's go for scales. This is a scaly period, isn't it?
Is it? Yeah. Leathery. Mind you, they meet a fishy one, don't they? So,
fish have scales. Yeah. Dinosaurs probably have scales. Stegosauruses have big scales on the back.
Yeah, and a scale is also a count of value. So
well, that's appropriate.
Yeah, it works even better.
So out of 100 dinosaur things, scales, what would you rate danger, dinosaurs, mark?
I don't want to get too Steve-o about this, trying to think what you're rating it against. I mean, as a dinosaur romp, I mean, I'm a fan of the Crichton books, which is obviously where you're going to go when you're thinking about how this stacks up.
Yeah.
And it's got a lot of, let's say, it gets there by different means. I enjoyed it. It's got a really flawed plot device, right, and slap bang in the centre of it, but that has interesting kind of offshoots. So... I would give it something like 63 dinosaur scales out of 100 dinosaur scales being a full dinosaur.
Dinosaur. Okay. Well, I also think it's a fun little story in and of itself. It's interesting to see Evan Hunter's style being played out days. I like the fact that actually a lot of it is stuff that you will come across in loads of different stories. The Jurassic Park things, it wouldn't surprise me to find that he hadn't read this.
Yeah.
Michael Crichton. Yeah. And thought, well, I can take some of these ideas. I don't know that. I think generally this is just sort of this thing that was in the air of science fiction and speculative fiction anyway. So it's, I don't know, it's good. In its own way. But it's also, like you say... reading it as a grown-up is a bit of a funny one.
Mm.
I'd be interested to read it to a kid. So when my niece is old enough, you have to read A Danger Dinosaur.
I would hope that my 20-month-old daughter would say, hang on,
it doesn't work.
I mean, she'd have to learn those words and be able to, but I think the concept she'd still read around it. But, you know, I'm talking from a 21st century kind of a sensibility. Yeah.
Well, I think I would rate it... I'm not going to rate it particularly high. I think I'd rate it 47.
Blimey, that is
47, low. You see.
Yeah, I feel like I've been way too generous now.
I'd like to read some of the other juvenile fiction things, and I might buy them and read them for pleasure. And it... I think my judgment is basically reflective of it as a Evan Hunter thing. I think that's the
It's not just if you were doing this against the.
No, you certainly couldn't compare it to King's Ransom or something like that.
Yeah.
But I think I've just got to look at it in that terms of that.
Yeah.
Which gives us an overall score of what was that, Kenneth? Portable Kenneth's very quiet. It gives us an overall score of 55 dinosaur scales.
Right.
It better do, otherwise Kenneth needs to recalibrate it.
I reckon so. I reckon he's got it.
I think that's okay, isn't it?
Without any rounding.
Without any rounding whatsoever, up, down, sideways, through time, or anything. Okay. So I think we're going to have a round up there completely. I'm going to say thank you very much, my brother Gary Abbott, for attending to the matter of Danger Dinosaurs with me.
It's been a pleasure.
Okay. We'll be back soon with 80 Million Eyes in the main series. Promise, I keep saying that. We will be back soon with that in the new year. Happy New Year, everyone. And merry dinosaurs.